devoted to promoting the interests of the Cuban population, but not the interests of U.S. corporations. And they say this straight out, that we don't like having a government in Latin America that puts the interests of its own population ahead of the interests of U.S. corporations. And if we allow this to happen in Cuba, they say, it may happen in other Latin American countries.
And that would be shocking.
Horrifying. So the determination of the United States to oppose and then quickly to overthrow and destroy the Cuban Revolution is just really clearly laid out as a way of promoting U.S. corporate interests and the U.S. policy for economic development that relies so heavily on private foreign investment.
So this is a policy that really began in earnest in this hemisphere with the overthrow of the Arbenz government, and this counterinsurgency policy being rewritten, reconstituted, re-envisioned, continues even as we try and change our relationship, or the U.S. government tries to change its relationship with the Cuban government. It wasn't a very good sign to me when within, I think it was the next day, or was it the same day, after the initial announcement in terms of the what was going on with the exchange with Cuba, that the Obama administration came down full scale on Venezuela.
And I mean, the Latin American countries were watching all of that very closely. There's a saying that it's not coming to my mind about something like the beast not changing its skin or something, changing its colors. I think the fact that the goals of the United States have not changed, and to sort of try to reassure, I mean, another thing just to keep in mind in terms of the goals of the United States being to promote U.S. corporations and foreign investment, which they say very clearly back in the 1960s, is that the U.S. business community in general has been chafing against the embargo. And in Obama's announcement yesterday, he also called upon Congress, and I should just clarify in case the listeners aren't completely aware of how all this works, but some aspects of the U.S.-Cuban relationship can be changed by the executive, but the embargo since 1996 has been written into law by Congress, so it can't, it can be tweaked by the executive, but it can't be removed without congressional action. So in Obama's announcement yesterday, he was calling on Congress to revisit the embargo and perhaps end the embargo. But this is something that the U.S. business community has been calling for repeatedly for the last decade at least, as Cuba has opened fairly wide its economy to foreign investment. And the Canadians and the Europeans have been rushing in, and the U.S. has been shut out because of U.S. law.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're speaking with Professor Avi Chomsky. We're talking about Cuba, the exchange, now the opening up of embassies in each country. Maybe we can conclude this way, Professor Chomsky. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that we've had the next presidential election and we've got President Bernie Sanders. And he's looking for an ambassador to go to Cuba. And he gets many recommendations that it should be Professor Chomsky. If you were called into the Oval Office, you were having a discussion, getting ready to go, what are the kinds of policies you'd want to be talking about and thinking about implementing?
I think there's a couple of issues that that are really high priority from the Cuban perspective. One is the embargo. One is the covert actions, and one is Guantanamo. So as ambassador to Cuba, well, I mean, first of all, I would probably refuse to be ambassador to Cuba because it would force me into doing a lot of things that I don't want to do.
Okay, run with me, please.
But I would, I guess I would try to make those three issues high priority issues. One, closing Guantanamo. Two, ending all covert action and U.S. unwanted U.S. intervention into Cuban affairs, that is, truly respect Cuban sovereignty and the right of the Cubans to determine their own form of government and their own form of economy. And three, ending the embargo.
Why is Guantanamo so important?
Oh, Guantanamo. Well, it's part of Cuba, right? The U.S.
Yes.
has maintained a military base in Cuba since 1902 against the will of the Cubans. So, of course, Cuba isn't the only country in the world where the United States has maintained a military base in the face of great opposition from populations. A lot of people don't want U.S. military bases in their towns, in their regions, in their territory. However, it's generally done through agreement with the government of the country. In the case of Cuba, the base in Guantanamo is maintained against the expressed desires of the Cuban government, which has refused to acknowledge, and that is, it has claimed sovereignty of all of its territory and refused to acknowledge the right of the United States to keep part of Cuba, which is a remnant, basically, of colonialism, of the U.S. occupation of Cuba from 1898 to 1902.
Got it. Well, we have been speaking with Professor Avi Chomsky. She is the author, most recently recently re-released, A History of the Cuban Revolution in paperback. She teaches at Salem State University in Massachusetts, and she is the coordinator there of the Latin American Studies Program. Professor Chomsky, pleasure to have you with us on Flashpoints.
Great to talk to you, Dennis.
All right, bye-bye now.
Bye.
Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we continue our drumbeat coverage of the situation, well, in the Dominican Republic and Haiti. In the Dominican Republic, they are forcing thousands of citizens, of folks who grew up in the Dominican Republic, out of the country, back into Haiti. It's creating suffering, chaos, and it may very well be a ploy to undermine upcoming elections in Haiti, where for the first time in a long time, the Lavalas party is allowed to run. Joining us to talk about the situation just back from the region is Robert Roth. Robert Roth is the co-founder of the Haiti Action Network. This is his sixth fact-finding tour to Haiti. He's a veteran high school teacher here in the Bay Area at Mission High School, 27 years there. Robert Roth, it is good to have you back on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much, Dennis.
Well, begin by giving us an overview of the project. What was the reason you went, and where did you go?
Well, I haven't been back to Haiti since President Aristide's return in 2011. And, you know, I went with Pierre Labossière from the Haiti Action Committee, and we wanted to understand the change conditions in Haiti, not just with the current crisis with the Dominican Republic, but also the fact that Lavalas is standing for elections for the first time in 15 years. And what does that mean for the movement in Haiti? And what does it mean for the political conditions there? And we also wanted to go and see the incredible work being done at UNIFA, the University of the Aristide Foundation, which through the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, we've been in solidarity with and given support to. So those were some of the reasons that we went on this trip.
Okay, let's start with the chaos that's happening at the border. We should explain that Haiti shares an island with the Dominican Republic. It's sort of divided in two. There's a lot of history there. The Dominican Republic, well, explain to people what led to this mass purge and this push of folks out of the Dominican Republic. Set that up for us.
Well, the Dominican Republic in 2013 passed a law that revoked the citizenship rights of Haitian immigrants who had been in the country, who had been born in the country after 1929. And that involves 250,000 Dominicans of Haitian origin. And they instituted a policy of mass deportation of Haitians, of not only Dominicans of Haitian origin, but also of Haitians who they called undocumented. Now, we're very familiar with that kind of draconian and racist policy in our own country, with the Obama deportations of Mexican and Central American immigrants. And in Haiti, in the Dominican Republic, this is has a particularly racist character, as it's aimed at Haitians and at really at black people in the Dominican Republic. And so it's a form of ethnic cleansing. And what's happened over the past couple of months is that any Haitian in the Dominican Republic has been in danger. And so, you know, Haitians have, they work in the sugarcane fields. They own, they have like little shops and sell things in the Dominican Republic. A lot of Haitians, there are 30,000 Haitians who go to college in the Dominican Republic. And Haitians go back and forth to the Dominican Republic all the time. They do business in the Dominican and come back and forth. And so people have had their shops burned. They've had their houses destroyed. There have been lynchings in the Dominican Republic of Haitians. It's reminiscent of so many. You could give so many examples. You could look at Palestine. You could look at what happened in the South, you know, in the early 1900s with the, you know, with the lynchings by the Klan that led to the Great Migration. These are the conditions that Haitians face now. And so that has led up to this really tragic and racist, you could almost say, you know, a pre-genocidal situation in the Dominican Republic that we're trying to call attention, like worldwide, to.
And I understand, actually, that there are reports that some of these folks, they're getting chased out of their houses, dragged out of their houses. We've seen folks dressing up in Ku Klux Klan outfits. Is that a fact? Is that true?
Yes. Yes, that is a fact. That is a fact. And one of the things that we did was a Lavalas organizer, Lavalas, which is the movement in Haiti, the popular movement in Haiti that, you know, brought Aristide to power many years ago and won elections whenever it has stood for election in Haiti, and is the most popular political party in Haiti. They're taking a very proactive approach to this crisis, while the Haitian government has done literally nothing to support the people who are being forced out of the Dominican Republic. And a Lavalas organizer took Pierre and I to the border and, you know, to just investigate the situation. And we went with journalists from Teletimoun and Radio Timoun, which are connected to the Aristide Foundation. And Dennis, as a journalist yourself, you would have been so impressed with these young, activist, powerful journalists. We were thinking about you when we were with them, because it's a new generation of journalists who are absolutely fearless, courageous, wanting to get the news at all costs.
Well, that gives me chills. I just have to throw in that I trained a journalist named Lynn Duff. That was her name at the time. And she was training with Pacific News Service. And she went down there. And I think she brought the first microtransmitter radio station. So I think we've had a little finger in it.
Uh-huh.
Go on.
And,
I'm sorry.
And so these journalists, we were going to the border. And we were going to the place called Malpas, which is one of the sites where Haitians, when they cross the border, when they leave the Dominican Republic, they have to stop and they have to register at the Haitian border with Haitian authorities, and they get a little green registration card, and that lets them come into Haiti. And as we were going to the border, there was a bus filled with Haitians and overcrowded with all of their belongings, right? One of these, just overflowing with, you know, one bedding and in their trunks and suitcases. There must have been 70, 80 people on that bus. And the bus had been stopped by Haitian police, who wanted them to go back to the border and re-register. And these people had had it. They were not going back to that border. And they suspected that the reason that they were being asked to go back to the border was so that the Haitian authorities could get some money off of the deal. And they were staging a protest in the middle of this road. They were blocking traffic, and they were saying they would not, under any threat, they would not go back to the Dominican border. And these were people, there was a pregnant woman, 5 months pregnant. She said, my child is sick. We had been under attack at that in the Dominican Republic. My other kid was attacked by someone, by Dominicans. My house was burned. Another man was saying that he had lived in the Dominican Republic for the last 10 years and that his belongings had been burned. They were not going anywhere near that border. And so the Lavalas organizer took us back to the police station, and he organized, he made it very clear these people are not returning to re-register. And he said, the only way that you're going to defuse the situation is you go talk to the people. You want to register them again over there, 15 miles away, you can do it. And then, of course, they asked us as, you know, Americans, like me with my American passport, to say a few things. And the police then went back, talked to the Haitians, and the situation calmed down. And then the organizer was inundated, the Lavalas organizer was inundated with requests for cards for Maurice Narcisse, the Lavalas candidate for president, because all these people now wanted to support Maurice, because they had been given concrete help in, you know, support from Lavalas to actually help them as they were, you know, as they were dealing with their situation. This is day by day, Dennis. In other words, people are coming from that border day by day. They're facing crisis at every step of the way. In the Dominican, once they get to Haiti, then what are they going to do when they get to Haiti? And so it's on every level, it's a horrific situation.
And it's, again, to be clear, it's Lavalas reaching out and filling in a huge gap, one more huge gap that is being left there by the current U.S., shall we say, imposed government. And I guess just in term, before we move to the elections, what is the worst case scenario here? I mean, we have a situation in Haiti that's already horrific. The poverty is overwhelming. We've got 250,000 or more people being purged from the country. It could really turn into a massive tragedy.
Well, I think that the worst case situation is that, I don't know, I think the worst case situation is that this becomes one of the critical human rights disasters in the world, in the entire world. And we're living in a world in which you could name 15 of those. You could name them in the Middle East, you could name them in Central America, and you could name them in Haiti. So I think that, yes, I mean, this is a country that is barely recovering from the earthquake. You know, you can, you know, so the 10 cities have been removed from the center of town, but if you go through Haiti and you go through Port-au-Prince, they are still there. There are hundreds of thousands of people living still in displaced refugee camps, right? They're not as visible, but they're there. And then there are the shanty towns. And then there are now the people being displaced from the Dominican Republic. Plus, there are people who are being displaced through the tearing down of homes that they have lived in for generations because of redevelopment plans that have come to pass through all of the money that has come in for redevelopment. We were in a part of the city where 60,000 people had their home destroyed in a two-day period last May through a $40 million redevelopment plan headed by the former Prime Minister Lamont, who was very, very close to the Clinton Foundation. And these people returned from, you know, from their work in the markets and in other, you know, parts of the informal economy, and they found themselves with no homes. And one of the presidential candidates, Jean-Henri Seyon, who is a notary public in Haiti, was part of that deal, did all of the legal work for that deal, and got $4 million.
Who will live in these new houses?
Who knows? Nothing has been built. Nothing has been built.
Nothing has been built.
You know, nothing has been built, but the homes are now totally torn down, and people are living in buses, and people are living in the remnants of where they used to live. There's sewage, open sewage, which, of course, is the base for cholera, which is spreading, not under control at all. You know, so these are the conditions in which Lavalas is attempting to, you know, really run an electoral campaign, speak to the needs of the people, and attempt to create a situation in which people have a voice and have a chance at, you know, some gains, some improvement in their lives. You know, now the danger is that if it appears that Lavalas can win the election, many people believe that there will be some maneuver to prevent the election from happening. There's already talk that there'll be one round of elections that will be parliamentary, but that when it comes to the presidential election, that there will be a push by the international community, so-called community, meaning the U.S., the U.N., et cetera, to do a transitional government for 3 years to so-called stabilize Haiti once again. So the situation is very delicate. And, you know, for us in Haiti Action Committee, we're going to try to educate people because we don't think that, you know, as always, the situation in Haiti, unless there's the earthquake or the Dominican, you know, the Dominican crisis, Haiti is often on the back burner of people's consciousness. And yet here you have the first Black Republic. Black lives really do matter. And they matter in Haiti, you know, as they matter all over the world. And Haiti is in both a crisis, but there is such a powerful movement. And it operates on so many different levels. And it's like, for example, we went in the middle of all this, Dennis. We go to UNIFA, and there are hundreds and hundreds of students quietly studying for their final exam.
That's the Aristide-founded university.
The University of the Aristide Foundation. Medical students, law students, nursing students, students in physical therapy. And next year, they're going to try to open a school of continuing education where you don't have to have a degree. You don't have to have, you know, any certificate or pass any standardized test to go take college classes there. They want the grassroots to be able to go study at a university and take courses and feel part of the university experience. And you walk onto that campus and you see a new generation being trained and being educated and not having to go to the Dominican Republic where they could be forced out and racially profiled at any moment. And so, you know, there's a broad-based movement that gives you not just hope, but gives you a model of ways that, you know, we could operate in a lot of movements around the world, including here, but it's a real struggle.
And it is amazing. Anybody who's been to Haiti and has, one, seen the extraordinary poverty unimaginable in the United States. I mean, profound. And also felt the spirit of a people so poor, but so in love with self-determination and democracy that they have suffered every kind of injustice. Now, there is some concern, before we say goodbye, Robert Roth, that this decision, the timing of this decision in the Dominican Republic was in part a way, a scheme, if you will, to disrupt, as an excuse, you were talking about to undermine the presidential election, using this as the point, too much destabilization, this is happening at the border, we can't have these elections.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, I think that there are very deep roots. Like, there's deep racism in what's happening in relation to the Dominican Republic and Haiti. So these roots go very far back into the history, and they have reappeared at many times in the history between the Dominican Republic and Haiti. So I wouldn't say that it's only about the election. But does the timing and the potential escalation of the crisis, could it influence and become a part of the electoral crisis? Absolutely. Could they use it in that way? Absolutely. Does the movement feel it could be used that way? Yes. No question. And there also have been, in the last week, there were killings in Cité Soleil, where paramilitary squads gunned down people in the streets.
That's a very strong supporter of Lavalas, of former President Aristide, and perhaps one of the poorest communities in the world.
Yes. That's the other way that people think the election could be sabotaged, is to create insecurity in one neighborhood after another. We were in Bel Air at a church festival, and, you know, and Bel Air is a very, very important area, and a massive Lavalas rally broke out. And it was incredible. You know, a powerful Lavalas rally broke out, you know, in the middle of the festival, and which showed the strength at the base that Lavalas has. And so the government knows this, the United States knows this, and they do not want Lavalas in power. So we can expect many different maneuverings over the next period of time, and it's worth watching very closely. And for those of us that love Haiti and love the popular movement and respect it, it's a time to be very, very vigilant and very supportive.
All right, we're going to have to leave it right there. We've been speaking with Robert Roth. He's just back from Haiti, his sixth fact-finding tour there. Extraordinary situation, very dangerous and painful situation going on at the border. We're going to watch it all very closely. Robert Roth, if people want to know more about what you all are doing at Haiti Action, what's the best way to do that?
Okay, I'm going to give two websites. Okay. One is www.HaitiSolidarity.net, and then HaitiEmergencyRelief.org. And those are the best ways to get in touch.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. Again, thanks so much for joining us on Flashpoints and for keeping us posted on this incredibly important story that the mainstream media continues to drop. Again, be careful. We'll talk to you soon. Out. In the middle of it all,
unfurled fish. In the timber by the door, by the hole, to keep the wind out. In the middle of it all, there's me. In the battle for it all, in the battle for it all, in the bottle of it, in the hollow of it, in the middle of it all.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And, well, we're going to take a look at policy by the Brown administration here in California. Yesterday, that would be Wednesday, the Brown administration finalized regulations on fracking and other dangerous oil extraction techniques that will allow oil and gas companies to continue to conduct these techniques at the expense of California's water, air, agriculture, and public health. That is according to Food and Water Watch, and joining us to talk about that perspective is Adam Scow. He is the California Director of Food and Water Watch. Adam, welcome to Flashpoints. Why don't you tell us exactly what the problem is, because Jerry Brown, who actually used to do a show right before mine here on KPFA, has always touted himself as an environmentalist at We the People. He was fighting for the environment. He has a reputation now as governor of California being on the cutting edge. So tell us about the policy and what's the problem.
Yeah, well, the problem is Jerry Brown is good on talk, but weak on action and follow through. Especially when it comes to challenging the power of the oil companies in California. And California has long had powerful oil companies, Chevron closest to home here, and they're engaged in some pretty nasty production techniques, especially in Kern County and other parts of Southern California, where 10% of the nation's crude is being extracted. That oil is being extracted by some dangerous techniques, including fracking. They've already been doing it over the last 10, 20 years here in California. The state has been mostly behind on keeping up with the oil companies. Just in the last few years, the state finally had to admit that fracking was indeed happening, and Governor Brown signed a bill that takes a very backwards approach to dealing with this problem. The bill was called Senate Bill 4. He signed it 2 years ago, and the bill allowed the oil companies to continue to frack, acidize, use a lot of water with toxic chemicals in the midst of our drought, while they conducted a study and an environmental impact report. However, as this skewed process has unfolded, we've learned that the study and environmental impact report have little to no bearing on the regulations themselves, which has been mostly put in place by an industry-friendly agency.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about what the dangers are. Maybe we can use the recent spill off Santa Barbara, which has been devastating and is still quite problematic, as an example of the problem. Maybe you can work that into the discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. The Santa Barbara Refugio oil spill that happened in late May was carrying oil from offshore rigs that are engaging in acidization, where they take very high concentrations of hydrochloric or hydrofluoric acid and dump it down into the earth to dissolve everything in sight to get to the oil. These rigs are also applying for permits to conduct offshore fracking, both in state and federal waters. That oil was going through a pipeline near the 101 alongside the coast, where it ruptured onto the beach and out into the ocean, and that oil has been found in beaches throughout Southern California as far south as Long Beach. And despite this terrible experience where we're seeing all these nasty chemicals, in addition to the oil being contaminated, being released into the Pacific Ocean, The state is now on the verge of approving 9 more offshore fracking jobs off the coast of Long Beach later this year. So it really shows the power of the oil companies in getting their way in California. You know, Jerry Brown, in his campaign speeches, has actually pledged to work with oil companies, and the result is very disappointing because when Governor Brown talks about getting off of oil, at the same time, he should also be calling for a reduction in oil production and oil drilling to simultaneously accompany that transition to electric cars, which is a no-brainer. We should all be doing that. The problem is that California, everybody can have an electric car, everybody can drive a Tesla, but if the way things are going, Brown will allow the oil companies to continue to frack, produce more oil, and if Californians use less of it, they'll just export it elsewhere.
Voice of Adam Scow. He's the California Director of Food and Water Watch. We're talking about the fact that Governor Brown signed finalized regulations yesterday in terms of oil companies and fracking. And well, it hasn't really been that well reported, and it's been hard to get information in terms of the extent of fracking in California. We know a lot more in the East Coast, and when we found out a lot more, when the folks in New York, for instance, found out a lot more, the governor put an end to fracking. What do we know about fracking in California, and what kinds of problems has it already posed?
Yeah, the challenge we face here in California is that the oil companies have been here and are already fracking, whereas in New York, where we successfully banned fracking with Governor Cuomo, in Maryland, we placed a statewide moratorium. But in places where oil companies are already producing oil, it's a much harder challenge. But that's the challenge we face in California and something we have to overcome in order to protect our water and our air and people's health who live by these nasty operations. You look at Kern County, where most of the oil production is in California. You know, I'm talking Bakersfield and these huge oil fields and the hills around Bakersfield. That's where about 70% of California's oil is located. Now, Kern County has some of the worst air quality, some of the worst water quality problems in the nation every year, and that's been that way for a long time and has some gross disparities in equality, income inequality in California as well. So when we hear about these so-called economic booms from the oil industry, it's really most of the profits, and this is quite common in our economy, are going to the top and leaving a lot of folks without much. And this is a boom and bust type of cycle as well. As soon as the oil is extracted, the oil companies will be gone and they'll be going elsewhere. However, that doesn't take into account the huge impact on water. This is a big concern, especially in a drought. We know in Kern County, some of the water they are using, mixing with toxic chemicals, is coming from our San Francisco Bay Delta. It's being pumped out of the south end of the delta down the California Aqueduct, down next to the I-5, all the way down to Kern County, where it is then destroyed by mixing it with toxic chemicals. And on top of that, after the toxic wastewater comes back up the well, is being dumped into aquifers. This has been reported by the LA Times. A big problem with the fracking is that there's no good solution for the wastewater, and really they're running out of places to dump it. And what they've been doing is dumping it into aquifers that have water of good enough quality that could be used for irrigation or drinking water. And this has been done complicitly with the EPA letting the state of California and the oil companies do this. And this has been a huge scandal. But in our minds, it just shows that there's really no safe way to frack. There's no such thing as good regulation. And that's why we're working to ban it.
Back to the Santa Barbara spill for a moment. Wasn't part of the problem that the kind of oil, it was part of this new thicker crude that needs better pipes, stronger pipes. These pipes were found to be old. It seemed that in this instance, it was the new oil along with the inability or the unwillingness for the agencies responsible to hold these corporations accountable that led to this devastating spill and the very inadequate cleanup.
Yeah, the oil quality is very poor in California. It's been compared to tar sands. the oil that's been extracted both in Kern and offshore, and to transport it, and to extract it and to transport it means that the oil companies are using a bunch of toxic chemicals to let the oil flow better. All types of different benzenes, acetones, methylene chlorides, really nasty stuff that if gets in our environment are the kind of things that can cause cancer and reproductive problems. We've done some water testing and some oil testing of that oil that's spilled in the Santa Barbara Channel, and indeed those chemicals are present and are being leached into the ocean as we speak. And some of those things probably cannot ever be cleaned up, and this is another ongoing risk of these problems. There's really no safe way to do this.
All right. Well, I guess there is a safe way to do it, but that's not to do it. Would really like to hear your, if you had 10 minutes to advise the governor in terms of what he should really be doing, what you think would be a program that would help save this environment, the water, the species that are now jeopardized off the coast, what would your advice be?
Well, I think the governor knows that we need to get off oil, and the governor is lacking courage in taking on the oil companies and forcing them to reduce the production of oil. It's only natural that as we're getting off oil, we start to reduce production, and a great place to start is by banning some of the most dangerous oil extraction techniques like fracking and acidizing that's responsible for about 20% of the state's oil production. So, Jerry Brown needs to get some guts. We're not sure if he has them. We know he loves to talk. He wants to go to Paris this fall and brag about what a great climate hero he is, or he thinks he is. But really, we need to push him and hold him to a higher standard in California. It's not good enough for him to compare us to other states that aren't doing anything. Really, we need California to be a leader for the country and for the nation and for the world, for that matter. But that means getting off of oil and reducing oil production. There's no shortcut around it. He's got to do it, and we're gonna make him do it.
All right, Anoska, how do people find out more information if they'd like about what you all are doing at Food and Water Watch?
Well, best place is our website, foodandwaterwatch.org. It's all spelled out, foodandwaterwatch.org. We have people joining this movement every day. It's very exciting. As an interim measure, people are banning fracking in their own communities to start a domino effect, something that we can build towards, get more counties, more cities, as we carry this momentum towards the statewide level.
Beautiful. Again, thanks so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Adam Scow. He is the California Director of Food and Water Watch. Thanks for the great information.
Thank you, sir.
That wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
And it is a couple minutes before 11 a.m. And coming up on the radio zine, we'll hear a short interview with academic radical Cornel West, who was in Portland for the Unitarian Universalist Convention last week. We'll also hear Valerie Carey, the sister of Miriam Carey, a woman who was shot and killed during an incident on Capitol Hill in 2013. And then we'll hear an interview from the program The Scholars Circle with journalist Heather Rogers, whose latest book is Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. So you're going to want to stay tuned for that. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and I have a couple announcements, and then we'll go to the radio zine.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and mobilizing.
Tell your story and join the conversation. For more information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
Portland School Board elections are May 19th. What are the candidates saying?
Hi, this is Julie Esparza Brown. I am running in Zone 1. As a Latina educator with more than 30 years' experience educating students with disabilities as well as English learners, that along with my life experiences as a Latina will bring a lot to the board and help us understanding the new diversity in our schools.
Tune into KBOO April 27th through the 30th at 5:45 for special school board election coverage.
Oops, sorry about that. It was a little old. I was just running what was on my board. So we'll go now to the Cornel West interview. Cornel West is a prominent Democratic intellectual and radical academic. He is professor of philosophy and Christian practice at Union Theological Seminary and professor emeritus at Princeton University. He has also taught at Yale, Harvard,